Hi, hello. Welcome to Season 5 of The Process Podcast, an interview series exploring the process of survival as a creative. We talk about money, mental health, relationships, the creative process itself, and everything in between. This season specifically focuses on creativity within the realm of environmental conservation and social public art. I'm your host, Shannon Byrne. Hannah Spencer does all of our design and branding, and Lonnie Webb runs our Instagram and makes many of our visuals. Big thanks to Jeffrey Silverstein, who was a guest on our last season, for letting us use his song, Given the Light, this season's intro music. Hope you all dig it.
Hi, hello. I'm going to try to make this quick because I had to turn off my AC to record this. Super stoked to share this episode with you. It is with my former fellow Elsewhere Studios resident turned friend. John K. Melvin is an international artist nurturing community dialogue around the intersection of art, nature, and community. He typically upcycles materials that have passed their traditional use. He's created public art exhibits for over 14 years and has become increasingly involved with works that highlight ecological concerns and the interconnectedness of systems. He's worked with organizations on large-scale public sculptures, such as the New York Council on the Arts, the Shenfin Foundation, Pulitzer Foundation in Taos, New Mexico, and many more, including this really beautiful sculpture using discarded drip tape from the Peonia area at Elsewhere Studios. He has a fascinating background, which he shares with us, and a very profound journey to finding art and accepting his path as an artist. He shares all of that, and he really, it's a very candid conversation, and I hope that you respect and appreciate that. I know I really appreciate him being so candid with me and sharing everything that he shared with our audience. And a part of that too is the history of Oakland, California in the 80s. And just, I learned a ton. I hope you do too. We also talk about the art industry and learn some fascinating tidbits about that, things I never knew before. And of course, the environment and stats around the use of plastic and some things that we can do to cut back the use of plastic. And of course, socially engaged art and specifically sculptures, and why John chose, how he got into sculpture and why he chose that as his primary medium today. His pieces are truly beautiful. They're large scale. They're either very organic or sending a message by using plastic that's been discarded. He works with many like hotels and governmental organizations on public art pieces. We talk about all of that and the role of art in creating change and everything. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. You can find John's work at johnkmelvin.com or on our show notes. I link to everything we talk about and some highlights at theprocess.co. Hope you dig it and catch you next time. See ya.
Start. Can you just share who's John Melvin?
Who's John Melvin? John Melvin, well, let's see. I am born and raised in California, Bay Area, Oakland. Lived around there for a while. And I don't know. I've been doing the art thing now professionally, I suppose, for 15 years, even though, like, probably most artists, I feel like I've been an artist my whole life. I was just in denial. And so it took a while to get through the degrees and, you know, studies and things like that. But I realized that was what I wanted to do, and so I kind of committed to it, and it's been the best decision I think I've ever made.
Yeah. How do you get to the point of making that decision? Like, what did that look like for you?
The expression, you know, you're tired of beating your head against the wall, you might want to stop, you know, but I think that that's kind of what happened, was that I realized that I was trying to do everything else but be who I was, literally. I've done everything from corporate America to driving trucks, and I tried it, and it didn't work. It wasn't for me, and so it's a little bit risky, you know. It's like that's just part of it, you know, the part of the lifestyle. But it's, you know, the finances and balancing all that kind of stuff like that. That's a little bit more tricky. But no, once I made that decision, I knew it, you know.
Yeah. What kind of art were you doing, like, as a hobby before you decided to pursue it as a career?
Mostly painting and drawing. You know, even my bachelor's degree is actually in painting. Mm. Although my thesis project there at Mass Art was my first public art project. And I made a huge plexiglass mosaic kind of thing that then was suspended in a stairway window. And it was sort of a map of the inside and the outside space combined. And so the shadows and the light cast on the inside was the outside.
Oh, cool.
Kind of making these conceptual connections. And that was, I guess I didn't really answer the first question, but that's kind of what lit the spark for me too. When I was going through undergrad and doing the painting, drawing thing, it was a lot of fun. And don't get me wrong, I think there's a lot of great work out there. But once I realized the impact that public art could have, and then the challenges from a sort of design point of view, as well as a management point of view, were something that also made sense to me. You know, having run a business, having worked in business and things like that, doing the back office side of developing a public art project with proposals and budgets and narratives and all this paperwork kind of made sense to me, having had been there. And then the conceptual side of it being public and really engaging in dialogue without necessarily focused on commodity so much. Like, people don't have to buy a piece of public art to appreciate it. They can just walk up to it and take a look at it and think about it. And so that was new for me too. And it was just, it lit a spark. And from there, so that was 2003, 2004. It's the most fascinating thing about it that I tell everyone is I was really scared to jump off the cliff and to say, okay, I'm gonna do this art thing. I'm going to make it work as much as I can. And even back then with the undergrad saying I'm going to make it work was scary, because I was still willing to balance it with, you know, day jobs, sign painting, teaching, whatever. But what I also noticed is that as soon as I jumped off that cliff, not knowing what was there, there was kind of a community that was there. Mm. You know, like that last year of school at Mass Art, when I graduated, not even, I don't know, 6 months after I graduated, I got a call from one of my former professors, and he left me this just unbelievably awesome schizophrenic, you know, middle of the night speed brain kind of voicemail saying, you got to call these people tomorrow morning, they're in France, don't call them now, they're 8 hours ahead, don't call them now. He called me at like 1 a.m. in the morning, and he's like, call them tomorrow, I've arranged everything, you've got a fellowship, you're gonna go over there, they need people like you, they need all this kind of stuff like that. And mind-blowing. Yeah. I just, you know, like within, yeah, so, you know, with, and then I went over there, and that was the first artist residency, fellowship, whatever you want to call it, that I did, and that was 2005. And it's just, I mean, there's been bumps. I mean, 2008, 2010 was not great, but for everyone, you know. But yeah, that was just kind of an example of what I mean, that when I jumped off the cliff, there were people there.
Yeah.
That sure. People respect that decision, they respect the integrity and all that.
Yeah. You don't strike me as a dude who would really be scared.
No.
You know, that's not something I would.
That's, yeah, and that's, I think that, again, we're the, I forgot who said it, but, you know, we're the sum of our experiences. I did a lot of things when I was younger, before I was 21, that, you know, let me put it this way, a good portion of the friends that I had from those years have, a lot of them are dead. And a fair number of them have been on anti-seizure stroke medicine since they were 20.
Wow.
And so I don't regret the things that I did in the past, because I don't believe in regrets. But, you know, it's I'm glad to be alive. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, the experiences kind of add up. I don't think it's that I'm fearless, because it's like definitely had my share of close calls. Even recently, I've had bad accidents on projects and things like that. So it's just, it was another thing too that I've learned through life, is that living in fear is, I mean, I know it's a privileged thing, but living in fear is just really not an option. I can't imagine that. And so I just kind of refuse to accept it, you know?
Yeah. I definitely want to dig into the progression of your art career, but before that, do you mind if we dig into some of the past stuff a bit?
Sure, go for it.
Mainly, like, what, I don't need to get into details, but, like, what brought you to those darker places?
You mean why was I into that sort of dark lifestyle and everything else?
Yeah,
I don't know. There's a lot of different reasons. And, you know, I could say, like, you know, like the old cliche story is, you know, latchkey kid, broken home, all that kind of stuff like that. I don't think it was that. I think that there was something in me from really an early age, even when I was 10 or 11, there was kind of a daredevil thing. And whether that was, you know, taking a skateboard down the hill or burning plastic and seeing how it felt, you know, there was just something that I needed to do. And I don't know why. That's not a why. That's not an answer to the why. There's still another why there. It's just an adrenaline thing. I don't know. It's complicated, too, because, you know, the philosophically, I could probably extrapolate and say that the 80s were really weird. You know, I came out of middle school 89, and 89 was, I mean, for a Californian, it was a year for the books. You know, we had the big Loma Prieta earthquake, that the Bay Bridge, everyone saw that one, but also the Cypress Freeway structure in Oakland that really hurt a lot of people and a lot of families. It collapsed. There's all this other stuff happening. The Berlin Wall came down.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, you know, and so I think that there was part of that kind of, you know, kind of, it was in the ether, basically, especially I think for Americans that, you know, with, and then we had, you know, the usual politicians. And it's like, is it over? Are we going to come to an end? Is it, you know, yeah, is the world coming to an end?
Kind of like how it feels right now?
Kind of like it feels now. It was, and especially the school that I went to, it was sort of unfortunate because, and I think that's a good point, because it really was really cultural. I mean, I remember, so it's middle school, right? So, you know, 11, 12 years old. I remember friends of mine that were 11 or 12 years old and already on heroin. I remember people getting, you know, busted by the police. We would almost always have a police car breaking up a fight, almost, I mean, at least once a month, if not a little bit more. And we had, like, a really rough and rowdy bunch that was coming through the school. And so it was intense, this feeling that it just, nothing else mattered, you know, to quote the songs. But it's just, yeah, that's really how it felt. It's just like nothing mattered and that it was done. We were kind of over and we were forgotten and all these kind of things like that. We had mixed messages. I mean, you know, my generation, we were the first ones to come of age sexually in the shadow of AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just, you know, it's like, you just kind of felt abandoned on so many levels. It's like, great, we can't have sexual fun because, yeah, you know, we've got to do everything else, safe sex and everything else. And, you know, you're a kid, you're a teenager, you know, you're already shy about asking someone out. And
right.
Now you got to sweat bullets while you go either, you know, steal a pack of condoms or try to buy one or whatever. I mean, it's just, there just seemed to be all these different hurdles socially and culturally to really becoming ourselves, because it was such a moving target. And so I think that, you know, unfortunately, I think my parents and my family were always heartbroken about it in a way, because it was just the timing. I don't think it was anyone's fault. I had a great family life, but it was the times. I almost flunked out and almost got held back in middle school because I stopped going to school. I spent the last year and a half probably, I mean, it's a bit cliche, but I spent the last year and a half going to detention every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just became a thing. And I did. I got in with the bad kids. And it just kind of goes from there. And I think that, so when, you know, by the time high school came around, it was, the pattern was already set. And it also became one of those things, too, I remember, is that, and this is something I still kind of battle with, but just by my appearance, people assume that I'm into whatever, speed, coke, crank, dope, whatever. They just assume. I think that, you know, when you're a kid, that was kind of unfortunate, because even, you know, even if I didn't have the tattoos and the earrings, it was kind of like, well, shit, I might as well do it.
People were going to think that about me anyway.
Oh, I went to one school briefly for a while, and, you know, like they were convinced that I was already smoking crack. And
it's pretty unfair.
It's kind of like not even giving you a chance, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like the new kid and everything else.
Is that just because you're like a skinny kid? Or?
I think it's that. Skinny kid. I don't really know why. Because, yeah, the tattoo's going to come in until 2 years after that. But I think that was the thing. It did. It just kind of all steamrolled. And then, you know, there's like some family stuff, but it's just, I don't know how important it is. My family went through some struggles. You know, the 80s, 90s were not that great either economically. And not only did my parents divorce, but dad wound up losing his business. My sister moved away to a foreign country. So, like, there were a lot of changes going on.
Yeah.
And then to have it all roll together was tough.
Before I will ask you how you got out of it, but before that, have those experiences informed your art today or your art in the past?
I hard to say because, like, you know, quite frankly, there's when I started using dope, like, and it was hard stuff. I was big time into the powders and pills. And once I got into that, I really don't remember anything. It was quite common for me to, you know, wake up on a Sunday morning or a Monday morning in my house and have no idea how I got there and not even remember the last few days.
Mm. How long was that?
The heavy use was about 4 years, 5 years.
How old are you?
Started when I was 16, 17 and kept going until I was 20. Managed to quit by 20 with, you know, the odd hiccup here and there, but the habitual stuff was done. You know, doing it every day or every weekend or whatever. That was just during those 4 years. And the reason I don't know how it influences the work because it's really kind of hard to tell. A lot of people that have done meth and come out of the other side know what I'm about to say, but we always kind of struggle with a serotonin deficiency. Mm. And it's as far as I can tell, it's basically permanent. That's hard. So that affects my work. But it's weird because it's not always a positive and it's not always a negative.
Yeah.
You know, like Claire, like my current partner, like her and I talk about it a lot. But the funny thing about it is that because of the, you know, because of the past and things that I've done to my wiring, in some ways I'm never satisfied.
Yeah.
Which is a hell of
always
a motivator.
Like looking for that, the high, know? For lack of a better term.
You're always looking for a high. And so it's like, you know, whatever the exhibition is or whatever else like that, I'm just constantly, well, I could do better. You know? Mm. Or that was fun. Let's try to do this or something like that. I don't know visually if it affects the things or not. I mean, I think my visual vocabulary is, for the most part, you know, connected to, like, my kid years when I was, you know, before 10. So, you know,
really?
And really pivotal between 5 and 10. That's my visual vocabulary.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. My dad, the business that he had and he ran for 20, 30 years, I think, was control systems engineering, which is a fancy way for saying automation. Mm. And so most of his clients were food factories and the big ones, big name brands, all of them. And so you walk inside, you know, a big industrial facility like that, and you got tubes and plastic and shiny stuff and construction stuff and materials and... That was the whole thing. And so that to this day is still kind of my visual vocabulary. I've intellectualized it through grad school and all that. That's now it's upcycling and reclaiming and all those kind of things like that because it is, you know, because that's the world that we live in now, which I guess kind of in a full circle way connects back to that, you know, feeling that a lot of kids had in 89 is if it's coming to an end, then what are we going to do? And so me making art out of trash kind of fits.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So how did you, what made you quit the hard stuff, the drugs, and how did you get out of that dark period?
Two things happened in relative succession. There was a bad OD that happened.
Mm.
And then there were some changes in the community, let me say. And so the OD was really frightening, and, you know, waking up surrounded by friends, and I don't want to go into too much detail because I don't really want it to make it too much detail public.
Yeah.
But waking up and being surrounded by friends was a wake-up call.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second wake-up call was realizing that there were some elements that were moving into the community that were dangerous.
Mm.
And so I just kind of realized that it was time to go, time to leave.
Like, this isn't what I signed up for.
This is not, yeah, it wasn't fun anymore. Yeah. And I think that was the thing. And, you know, and I don't know, again, you know, whatever it was, whether it was sociological changes or what, you know, the mid-90s now, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it just, yeah, it wasn't fun anymore. And, you know, people were, there. You know, friends of friends were getting hurt and this kind of stuff. And it's just like, no, this is not good, you know.
Yeah.
And there was division. Like, I had a small group of friends, and the small group of friends were just starting to divide, and the larger group of friends were starting to work against each other, actually, in some ways, very dangerously. And so it's just time to go, you know. And it was, it's weird because it was, I think, you know, historians can probably talk about it better, but it was kind of the peak of the drug culture there in the Bay Area. Big Fed busts and things like that happened. But it was just kind of awful. So it's time to go. And luckily, I had an opportunity to leave, and I did. And it was just, you know, the girlfriend that I was with at the time, we liquidated everything and sold off everything, and I grabbed a plane ticket and left.
Where'd you go?
I went up to Seattle. Yeah. At the time, my mom was living there, and it sort of made sense for a fresh start kind of thing. I knew I couldn't be around the social circle that I had in California. I'd been there for 20-some years, and it was time to go. Seattle had, you know, school and opportunities. I knew it a little bit because I, you know, obviously visited. But I also didn't have any social circle there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for cleaning up, it kind of made sense. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, honestly, it's I've never had as frank a conversation with my family about this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, obviously they lived through it.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's any new information in this story, but I think that I am eternally thankful for them not really giving up on me. And that's kind of a shocker. There's a lot of people who didn't have that.
Yeah.
You know? There's far too many friends that a lot of us have lost.
Yeah.
I just didn't have it.
I think it's almost, I don't use the word blessing, don't want to say good thing either, but that you went through that so young. Because I feel like it's really hard to give up on someone that young.
Yeah.
You know? Having an entire life in front of you. Like,
yeah.
It's one thing when you're 30.
Yeah.
And, like, I have friends who, their families are finally, like, I can't. Not to say that that's a good thing. But, yeah. I think when someone's 20 years old, it's a little bit easier.
It's funny, you know. I agree. Flashing forward a few years. But, like, you know, I was in grad school. And at the time, my sister was working and living in San Francisco. Well, she still is. And her son, who is still to this day an incredible late night owl, but he was up in the middle of the morning and I was coming home from work or something like that. And he just came right out of the blue and he asked me about, you know, drugs and that kind of thing, culture and all that kind of stuff like that. Mm. And kind of similar to, you know, what you're asking about, like, you know, regrets, all that kind of stuff like that. Or, you know, whether he's try it, you know, just to know what it's like.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly what I told him, but I remember saying something along the lines that, you know, it's just too much of a risk, the potential loss of time. So, like, it's, you know, I appreciate you saying that, you know, maybe it's fortunate that I had those experiences early. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, I knew that because it took me a while to really kind of get my head straight once I cleaned up.
Yeah.
It took me a good 5 or 10 years.
Like, you had to grow up.
I had to grow up, and that's the thing that we know, chemically and scientifically speaking, is that, you know, people who engage in drug culture or whatnot at an early age they're disabling themselves. They're voluntarily disabling themselves developmentally.
Mm.
Full stop. It's proven, and so it's just, it's hard.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it is what it is, and I'm like I said, I don't have any regrets about it. And, you know, over the years, like, it has been helpful, particularly the way the world's going. As, you know, my street radar is, I wouldn't, you know, no one out there would ever say that, hey, their street radar is bulletproof, because they'd just be lying.
Yeah.
But I think I could probably get in and out of any situation I wanted to.
Yeah,
I'm sure. You know, and so I'm thankful for that. That I can see something a mile away. And there is, unfortunately, I'm not recommending at all, but it does kind of have an application to a little bit to the art world, because, you know, we there is a party element within the art world, but there's also, you kind of, there's a hustle. And so to meet people on and get a 5-second read on them that you can make a decision on, yeah.
I imagine there's a lot of people who exploit others and situations, and
unfortunately, art is art is a speculative market, so it's there's a lot of money to be had if you can find it and steal it from someone else.
Yeah.
And it becomes that, and, you know, it's also the other side of it too. I mean, like, this is one of those little anecdotes or cocktail anecdotes that a lot of people seem to forget, but one of the reasons why, you know, oil painting came about, not the reason, but one of the reasons, is that they needed to transport the paintings easier, aka smuggle. Mm. And so when they moved from tempura or whatever to oil paint on canvas, well, canvas can be rolled up and stuffed into another container, stuffed into a crevice, worn inside a sleeve. Like, all of a sudden, you've just increased your options. When it's a thick, heavy board with a thick, heavy frame, it's not going to move very much, you know, so it's going to stay in a church and things like this. Of course, for the record, yeah, of course, it also encouraged exchange of information, exchange of culture, museums could really have traveling exhibitions, all these kind of things like this. And it also relieved some burden on the artist as well, because then they could actually, you know, oil on canvas was actually when the plein air movement really came about too, because before it really was just a studio practice. Then now all of a sudden artists could actually go out there and paint. So we wouldn't have had Van Gogh if there wasn't, you know, oil on canvas to a certain degree. But there's a little bit of smuggling in there too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's just, and I don't know, that's just one of the fascinating things about it, but yeah.
It also sounds like some of this might all tie into the fact that you've chosen public art and that you're kind of, you're seeking opportunities or opportunities are coming to you in which that are like these contract jobs type, yep. Right? Essentially where yep. You're building this big piece of work
yep.
Or works yep. Rather than making individual things and hoping someone buys them, right?
Yep. Yeah, because that was the other side of it too. Yeah, it's all different manifestations of the gig economy, as far as I'm concerned, and that's what I saw happening in San Francisco when I was still doing day jobs. Was at the most you'd get a contract for, you know, 6 months or something like that. Hope to see another one on the other side. You don't know, but that was the other side of it too that I realized. Particularly, you take a place like the Bay Area, which is now more expensive than New York. You know, most artists can be looking at an overhead of, you know, $10,000-$12,000 a month.
Yeah.
For a studio, for heating, for transportation, for food, for assistance, for labor. You know, anything that's going to fall in there. And sculptors, you know, if the expression is that we love to complain, but there is a simple fact that most sculptors require a little bit more infrastructure. If they're going to be doing metal, they're going to need gas. If they're going to need more electricity, they're going to need more tools and all these things like that. Same thing with wood. And so, you know, the costs go up. And that was one of the things that I realized too, like in 2012 was when I lost my studio, when I gave it up really, because it just didn't make any more sense to be paying the amount of money that I was paying for it, to store sculptures in it, to on the hope that they would sell. And I did sell a few, but not enough to balance the budget. Mm. And then what I also noticed, too, is I just put it down on paper, and I said, you know, what's the cost-benefit ratio of spending $40 for each open call juried exhibition that's out there between here and Poughkeepsie? Yeah. You know, and then paying all the money that I'm going to pay for the overhead in the studio, paying for storage. I mean, there was one point where I had like 3 or 4 storage units. And I'm pretty sure that this is quite common for a lot of visual artists. And when I put it all down on numbers, it was like, well, you know what? I'm working a part-time job to support the art habit that is costing me more money than my part-time job is paying. I'm not doing very well in managing my debts and things like that. This is not working. It doesn't add up. It doesn't work. And it was shortly after that that I started thinking a little bit differently. I went back to teaching momentarily at the university level, but even then it was the same thing. As you know, I took on a job where I was working 60 hours a week, and I'd get like maybe 4 hours on the weekend to actually work on my own stuff. Mm. And then you still had to do all the paperwork. You had to apply for the shows, all that. And that's when the bell went off. And for a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of conversation out there about the residency circuit. And I think that wasn't when the bell went off for me. It was that this was an opportunity to hit the road for a little bit, eliminate the overhead, and actually literally put cash back in my pocket. Which, you know, and then it kind of helped me get through the first year or so of the residency circuit. And then, yeah, kind of like what I think you're implying, then it really did sort of steamroll, and it became sort of a snowball thing. It just kind of like, well, now I'm going to get another one. And once you get the first few residencies, then you're building up that image of trust that other institutions can say, okay, we'll give you some money, we'll give you the time, you can do this, we'll do that. And then it just kind of goes from one thing to the other. And also too, so that's the practical side. And then the other side was that, you know, the more I read economically, the more I read scientifically, and the more I read culturally, it really became kind of apparent that this whole, you know, peak stuff thing was real. And I started to see myself as actually part of that problem, you know, by being a stuff maker.
Yeah.
That, you know, like, is it, and also seeing what I've seen in the art world, which is a dirty secret that the art world doesn't like to talk about. Like 2007, we saw prices at art fairs for artworks. They were just astronomical, and they were almost completely absurd. And the problem is it's really inflated a lot of art prices, and it's, in a lot of ways, it's almost stopped the market in a ways that there's now, you know, the mid-level or even the mid-level entry point for a market is almost prohibitive. Anybody on the low level can't actually pay their bills. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then, of course, blue chip, they're all secured, but they're retailing at $1 million a piece. They don't need to do anything.
Yeah.
So it's kind of wild, you know?
It's kind of like, you got to get another macro example of what's happening on a macro
level.
You just kind of describe the working class, the middle class, and
that's
the rich.
It. Well, and that's what I realized too, was that, like, yeah, by artists working more and showing more or whatever, that we were actually making our own problem, you know? And it's like I said, you know, like, it's just simple numbers. If I'm going to pay $150 a month, which is the cheapest storage unit in the San Francisco Bay Area, last I checked, I could be wrong, but if I'm going to pay $150 a month, 12 months a year, whatever, to store a few sculptures, you're going to spend, you know, $1,500, $2,000, $3,000 a year to sell this stuff.
Right.
And you want to tell me this makes sense?
Yeah.
And you're going to sell one of the sculptures you need to make a few thousand back on it anyway, just to cover your end, and you still need to make a few thousand on it to cover the storage?
Right.
And then you need to make a few thousand back on it to cover all the exhibition fees that you sent off for, that the shows that you didn't get or you did get. And it's like, yeah, folks.
So you need to charge at least like 10, 12 grand for it.
And then the price is too high, and now you've priced yourself out of your niche market, which was emerging or alternative or subculture or whatever, where you were selling to people, you know, that were, you know, maybe making a little bit more than you if you were working a regular, not you personally, but, you know, a little bit more than, you know, $40,000 or $60,000, where they could actually afford, maybe on a gift kind of thing, a $3,000 painting once a year, sure.
Yeah.
But not at 12, and it's not going to be an impulse buy, and, you know, and then you're a sculptor, and it's like, well, it's not a painting anymore, now it's a big ugly thing that they have to dust, you know, and so, and that was a thing that I just kind of, it just doesn't work, again, because the numbers, I mean, like, you know, you look at, like, the juried exhibition stuff, and granted, I've been a juror, so I totally understand the economics of the entry fees, but, you know, looking at it more holistically, I think that we've all kind of, the art world has to kind of start working together a little bit, because if you're going to ask an emerging artist to send off 10 applications per month, that's $450 they're spending on applications, full stop.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to do that every month, plus all those other numbers I just rounded off.
Right.
So for me, it was like, I'm not going to do that. I've got a little bit of savings put together, and I'll go into the residency circuit. And I'm kind of blown away, but I think it's working. You know?
So can you explain for people who aren't in the art world what the residency circuit is?
Yeah, I think the term really got born only a few years back, but there's a couple different things that happened. Artists in residence, residencies, or artist residencies, are kind of a unique little hybrid. They're not a doctor's residency. They're not an internship. You're not living there, but you kind of are. The simplest way that I've ever been able to explain an artist residency is it is fundamentally a gift of time. And from there, it's up to the artist and the institution to sort of figure out how that gift of time is going to be managed. And there's a lot of different categories of artist residencies, but I want to keep it as simple as possible, so that's that. The residency circuit is this thing that, in my opinion, and some other people too, there's a podcast up in Canada that did a really good podcast on this thing. I think it's called MoMA or something like that. I can't remember what it was called. But the residency circuit kind of came about when, not to be too blunt, but when airfares really got cheap. That's when all of a sudden it became relatively possible, you know, because all those things kind of happened at the same thing. Airfare went down. Like when Ryanair came online was when I think the residency circuit really kicked off, because then Europeans, I mean, they're really kind of spoiled. I spend half my time in Europe, so I think I have a right to say that. But the fact that they can catch a $50 flight from one end of the continent to the other we don't have that opportunity here.
Yeah.
You know? And so the residency circuit really kicked off there, and then the Biennale thing kind of kicked off too. And then all these things started happening. Art fairs kicked off everywhere because, you know, people could actually get around the world for less than $1,000. Yeah. And that's, you know, if you do your work and you search the ticket prices and things like that, that all of a sudden it made it possible. And it also, what it also did is for a lot of the artist residency programs, I really, for the record, I'm going to, you know, probably upset some people here, but I really think artist residency programs should do everything they have in their power to support the artist financially. I don't like the trend that's happening in the residency field right now. I get it. Economically, everyone has to manage what they manage. But the other side of the residency circuit that was sort of born from endowment management. A lot of residency programs would either have a benefactor or something like that that would gift them amount of money. And then they could generate interest off that. And that would actually, you know, help the artist or whatever. That doubled with the cheap airfare, the Biennale circuit, all these other things meant that all of a sudden if a residency program was offering a meager stipend of $1,000, it could actually cover the expenses pretty fair, you know, for a nomad type artist, you know, with someone who didn't have overhead, who didn't have to deal with rent for their apartment or something like that at the same time. But and then I think the whole thing kind of snowballed from there. I think that, you know, the fact that we now have the Airbnb economy, the fact that subletting is completely standardized in most of the big cities, I think it all kind of rolled together because those kind of things happened.
Funding for the arts is less and less. The NEA and
The fact that governmental funding here in the United States is less should embarrass every American because without the arts, we don't have culture. We don't have new ideas, and we're not really supporting our right to freedom of speech and democracy by curtailing the arts. The arts are really the vanguard. They're the ones that the artist might piss us off every now and then and make terrible works or ugly works or, you know, or do works that smell really bad, put shit on it or something like that, whatever. It doesn't matter. But the thing is, though, is the fact that the artists are constantly challenging society and pushing the line of taste, that's what keeps everyone on the ball. And so by cutting government funding, we're eliminating that opportunity. And one more thing on that too, by cutting government funding for the arts, which effectively is going to kill arts, it already is, it's affecting the arts programs here nationally. It's also sending a message to the younger generation that creativity and individualism and inspiration and you know, celebration of character and culture is not tolerated. That's the message that we're sending by cutting the arts. And I'm not sure whether the politicians get that. I'm not sure whether the country gets that, because it's not just about, you know, paying me so I can make a painting. It's not about that.
No.
It's about showing the world that we care for each other to have our own opinion, and that we want to support that, because artists, that's kind of what they do.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I'd love to for you to elaborate on that a bit.
Okay, sure.
For maybe like the lay, I think most of the audience here either buys art or wants to buy art if they can't, and definitely like goes to museums and galleries and stuff like that. But for the people who don't, how would you explain the role of art and exactly what you just said? Because I think what you said more so speaks to the people who kind of get it. And then also wrapping into like your role with your engagement with public art.
Okay. Yeah, and that's a question I actually get a lot. The simplest thing is the role of art, it's in every part of our lives. Whatever piece of furniture you love, whatever piece of, you know, computer equipment you love, whatever piece of fabric or whatever your color palette in your fashion, in your wardrobe, is influenced by trends in the art world. And someone somewhere had to design something. And whether they did it, as a fine artist, where they just wanted to be on a gallery wall or in a museum somewhere, or whether they did it as a graphic designer or an industrial designer or something like that, they went to art school and they learned from people who were pioneers in the field, who benefited from federal support, from NEA grants and these kind of things like that. And so there's a huge lineage that makes up the aesthetic of our built environment, of the world that we live in,
mm-hmm.
that is, it directly at the hands of artists. Everything we have and is every, we live in a visual world, and artists are the ones that make visual things. Yeah. And that's just, again, as simple as I can say it. And if we're not going to support that, then our world becomes gray and colorless. There's a great book that my sister and I think it really contextualized us, and it framed our world view, I think, from a very early age. She's 6 years older than me, but she read it first, obviously, but I read it later. And I think it was called, you'll have to fact check me on it, but it's like, it's Momo or Mama. I think it's Momo. And it's a fictional book, but it's about this little girl that somehow goes through a portal, kind of an Alice in Wonderland thing. And she gets stuck in this world of grays. And they're all gray businessmen with gray hats and gray faces, and they go to gray houses and they go to gray businesses and gray shops, and the streets are, you see where I'm going.
Yeah.
That's what the world's like without art. And it, you know, art, it gives us differences, it gives us color, it gives us power, it gives us hope, it gives us spirit, it gives us all those things like that, and it also connects us to other cultures. You know, so like it's even connected to, not to wear my hippie hat too strong, but it connects us to world peace. And it's what kind of makes us human, you know. That's one of the things that when I was writing curriculum, that was one of the things that I used to say a lot, but art is uniquely human. So yeah. To cut the funding of art is to kind of cut our humanity.
Yeah.
And it's hard. I think that, you know, particularly in this country compared to other countries, this country's always had a war of words, and about politics and about budgets. And unfortunately, the arts amounting to less than 1% or 2% of the national budget, it just doesn't compare to what we're spending on military, which is nearly 60%. It doesn't compare what we're paying our senators and people like that to argue with us in terms of what we should be getting back from the government.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's, I think that there are other problems that we can deal with. You know, this might be too a little too abstract, but that's another side of it too. And they talk about it in, you know, conversations on gentrification and things like that. But, you know, a lot of cities that have gone into urban decline or whatever, artists often move in because it's cheap. There's cheap areas to rent, cheap areas to squat, you know, move into a warehouse or whatever. And, you know, the irony is that they move in and they open up little cute cafes and cute little bars and cute little restaurants, and they put fresh coat of paint on the places, they put some color on the streets, and it all of a sudden gets trendy, becomes attractive. You know, we saw this happen, we've seen it everywhere. You name a city that's all done it, you know, but Mission District there in San Francisco has... There's a lot of people that are on both sides of the argument on that one, but that's really what happened. The artist moved in because it was cheap, and they made it hip, made it cool, and then everyone wanted to be there. And now the Mission is, you know, a pretty expensive place to be in.
Yeah.
But, you know, so, like, I guess, you know, like, it was one of my cousins, I'm going to try to tie it into the second part of the question now. One of my cousins talked about it, and I guess I was fortunate enough to grow up in a house where both my parents had college degrees, and, you know, we had regular subscriptions to Scientific American, to Newsweek, to Time, to Discovery, to Nature. There was a strong, you know, consensus within the house, within the family, that knowledge and information were valuable. Mm. Not always necessarily an appreciation of culture, although my mom really, you know, she, her degree is actually a master's in music. So we did have that. We had that love for life, I think, yeah. But along with knowledge and information. So I think that that's like one of the other reasons why I went into public art too, was that one of the things that I saw about public art, and it's the core of my focus still, is that public art, unlike other forms of art, it's much more direct at initiating a dialogue. You know, I'm not really a writer. I don't know if I could do, you know, radio or film or something like that. So I always had to make something because I like to. I like to work with my hands. But that's what I noticed, is that I could make an installation and or make a sculpture or something like that, and people would generally be engaged with it. They would stop and talk about it. Or if they happened to see me while I was putting in, they would ask me what I was doing. And so, like, instantaneously, there was just this organic, natural pathway to conversation.
Mm.
that I hadn't seen in studio art. It just doesn't happen. You know, this was all pre-social media, not to date myself. Yeah. So, you know, who knows what would have happened if I had really kind of come to, or if I had, you know, kept my painting going into the world of Instagram and you know, if I'd stuck with it for 5 more years or something like that. Maybe. I don't know. But there's also the tangible thing, though, too. So public art has an opportunity to engage people on these kind of subjects. And I think that particularly as my work has really drilled down on some environmental activist issues pretty blatantly in the last few years. Yeah, I think it's way outside the commodity realm now and completely inside the social practice realm, which is troubling economically because I'm a little bit worried how I'm going to survive. But yeah, I think that's
it's a concern that there's not enough people supporting.
Your question about it's all intertwined. Your question about grants and governmental funding. I mean, that's my issue right now.
People other than the super rich don't really have money to pay for art right now either.
This is the other side of it too. Artists have always been in denial about this. I mean, even people like Diego Rivera was a card-carrying communist. Yet he took Rockefeller's check. He took he took money from all the rich people because. Yeah. End of the day, whatever our politics are as artists, we depend on the 1% because that's how it's always been. They're the only ones that have disposable income. Mm-hmm. And so I think, but that's also why governmental funding is even more important. You know, I think you might have interviewed Anna McLeod, but like, you know, I've had a lot of friends from Ireland and places like that that are artists and other countries that really do support their arts. You know, I have to say I'm a little jealous because they really do have it easy. You know, they can apply for the same grant every year and almost expect to get it. Mm. As an American, that's just a reality that just doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Unless you've already made it. You know, once you get to a success level or something like that and you're already showing at blue chip galleries, okay, then you're going to get the MacArthur, then you're going to get the Guggenheim, then you're going to get the Krasner. It's like, then it just kind of goes from there. Because unfortunately, like, I know that sounds cynical, and I really don't want to perpetuate that rumor. But you do as much time as I do researching and looking at the CVs, there's kind of a trend there. And it's a bit shitty. And I feel like what Jerry Saltz is doing right now. Like, Jerry Saltz is really, you know, kind of leading the parade, saying we have got to do better by our younger artists because we're failing them right now. Mm. I don't know why anyone would want to go into arts. Yeah. If they love drawing, painting, sculpting, whatever, that's great. But, you know, I can totally empathize with their family right now because their family's like, yeah, but you're not going to make any money. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, it's tough because not only do you have to be good at what you do, but you have to be good at the hustle, especially as an American, because the bulk of it, I actually haven't gotten a government grant yet. I've gotten private foundation grants and private commissions, but I'm always worried about that kind of thing because it's like fishing in a pond. At what point do you run out of fish?
Right.
So, if we brought back government funding, and that's kind of why I connected it intellectually to freedom of speech. I'm sorry. Like, I really do kind of think that it's not just a cultural asset. It's kind of a constitutional thing that we should have an arts and culture support within a society. Because otherwise, you just have a bunch of gray people wandering around, and no one's going to ask questions, and no one's going to think differently. And that sounds more like a dictatorship or autocracy or something like that. It doesn't sound like a democracy.
No.
And it doesn't sound like a republic either. It doesn't sound like we're united, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, the question thing is an important one.
I think so. Actually, more than half of my family, my extended family, cousins, aunts, and things like that, when I was growing up, some of them have crossed the political line now. They're on the other side of the fence. But when I was growing up, an overwhelming majority of them were conservative. And so, you know, doing the typical American thing and going home for the holidays or, you know, whatever was always a bit awkward, but also eye-opening because I realized that, there is a significant portion of this country that really does think conservatively and that they don't embrace that idea of questioning and things like that. But I think too many Americans forget that, hey, man, that's how we started.
Yeah.
You know, like this country that, like, you know, John McCain, someone that I've always actually admired, because he was just a remarkable human. That was something that he kind of talked about too, was that, you know, Americans have really good morals and values. We believe in individualism. We believe in freedom. We believe in all these kind of different things. And I think that unfortunately, I'd love my country, but that's what really bothers me about what's going on right now, is that we seem to be losing sight of that. And that's troubling.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't know. And I think that that's the other side of it, though, too. I think that, you know, getting back to the public art, I think that's why it means so much to me, is because by taking the commodity element out of it, you know, maybe there's a backer, maybe there's a donor, maybe there's a commission or something like that, but the fact that the public doesn't need to buy a ticket to go and look at it, you know, that the museum is open and outside, basically, that kind of concept. I hope that that's, you know, something that's actually positive for the culture.
Yeah.
We can actually do something different.
So have you thought of any creative solutions to the current economical state of art? And, like, you know, if private and public grants seem to be dwindling or at least not growing.
I'm probably somewhat of an anomaly. You know, we just finished this symposium here in Paonia, and there was questions about hope. There was questions about, you know, how does an environmental activist survive mentally?
Mm-hmm.
It's, and I think it's something. There's an interview with Denzel Washington a while back, and he's really smart. Mm-hmm. And this, I can't remember the exact quote, but he was talking about the difference between fear and hope. And I think what he said was, or what I remember, is that the thing about hope is that we choose hope.
Mm.
And to me, that's really strong. That's really empowering. And that's, I mean, as much as I know about, as many climate change reports as I read, and as many forecasts as I read, because I have to for my work, I choose hope. It's troubling that, yeah, you know, I kind of feel like we passed the brink of absurdity, you know, five times over.
Yeah.
And that, you know, we should be more in a repairing civilization mode, but we're just not there yet. But I think that we're going to get there, that there's still a yet. And I think that the challenge, though, is that to get back to your question, I think that I don't think that we necessarily need a total system change, because that's just a hell of a long shot. How can you even get that to happen without collapse? So I think that what's more likely, and what I think that the brightest minds out there are talking about, is if we can make gradual changes with our economic and social systems, that hopefully in time will get us to on a path to where we might become more of an open society, things like that. One, you know, the key concept here is we're nearly 8 billion people. 9 billion people is guaranteed because of just birth rates. It's just population growth. It's going to happen. And then the other number that really makes a lot of sense to me, or not makes a lot of sense to me, it doesn't make sense to me at all, but becomes really interesting, is that on average, the world is throwing away 50% of its food. So I'm not really concerned too much about different ways to grow food. I'm more interested in different ways to manage food. I think that the organic trend is turning around. This latest case against Monsanto means that we should not at all rest on our heels. But we've won some major battles here for the organic industry, for, you know, no pesticide industry, all these things like this. I think that, you know, as long as we keep that vigilance going, mainstream farms, everybody's going to switch to no pesticide, because we're going to have to, because we're losing bees. We all know the negative news. So that being said, I'm not worried about that. What I am worried about is how we can start changing our currency to actually help people rather than hurt people. Right now, our currencies worldwide actually hurt people because they're connected to debt, and so we're actually holding people back. If we can switch away from that and move to, you know, create a new currency that actually takes people as you know, for value, and puts value on commodities that should be valuable, puts value on nature and environment the way things should be valued, because we haven't been using any of those. The irony is of our current sociological predicament is that we never put a value, a cash value, on nature, on, you know, fossil fuels. We didn't. We only put a cash value on once they're manipulated, once they're produced, once they're extracted. That's when they become a cash value.
Right.
Which is completely backwards, which is why we're kind of in the mess that we're in right now, where we're literally digging ourselves into a hole. Mm. So I think that's the other side of it too. Those are big, tall orders right there. But I think that what a lot of people can do is remember that people power is always the best power. And I'm not talking necessarily about demonstrations and things like that. I'm actually just talking about using the tools that we have. We all have to buy stuff no matter what we do. Mm-hmm. And I think if we can start thinking about making better decisions when we buy things, and then also thinking about buying less stuff, I think that that's going to go forward, which I know that's a really long answer, but I think that that's the art world is, I'm not really sure how the art world is going to deal with that.
Yeah.
But it's going to become a reality, is because I know, like, for example, I know a couple of painters there in Eastern Europe that have been selling to a very small collector base. Mm-hmm. And they are not naive at all. They are unbelievably paranoid about overtaxing their collector base. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, once your collector has four or five paintings of yours in their home, do they really need another one?
Right.
Yeah. So, but I think that that's the other side of it, though, too. If we do shift our economy globally to one that's less about stuff and more about people, then I think we'll start valuing things differently. So artists won't have to rely on making work to survive, that they can spend more time thinking about the work that they want to make and make that. You know what I mean? And so they're supported by, you know, some sort of a financial arrangement with their government or whatever it is, or, you know, like what some of the European countries are trying right now, but like a minimum salary for everyone. I think if we can get towards, we can start implementing those things, we can move forward. Because the other thing that's not being talked about is wealth redistribution.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the fact that the 1%, and I have friends in the 1%, but the fact that they're making money on money on money, that they're not actually working. There's not actually a product being made.
Yeah.
I think that that's something that is, if we continue to ignore it, then yeah, we will have collapse and revolution. But I think that everyone has to remember that collapse and revolution always ends in blood. I don't think that that's a good solution.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, rapid change, while it might be romantic and make you think of Dr. Zhivago or whatever, it hasn't worked out too well in the past. And I think that that's the other side of it too, is that, like, we all kind of need to dig deep a little bit and recognize that in the last 6,000 years, we've been here before. We've had these societal collapses, you know, from Sumer, Babylonia to now. We've seen this pattern. And so clearly the methods and solutions that we did before didn't really work. And so we kind of have to think about those things differently. And I think it's, if you, whatever you want to call it, if you want to call it neo-socialism or whatever, I'm not going to brand it. But I think that that's kind of what's going to happen. And it's, I know that the artists are going to have a hard time with it because it's been drilled to make work.
Yeah, it's kind of a contradiction, right? Because the world needs art. But at the same time, the world doesn't need more stuff.
Well, so. And I think we all kind of have to stretch our brains, you know, like it's kind of like with the whole social practice thing or like what Brian Cohen was talking about in the symposium about forensic aesthetics.
It's a bit contradictory.
Yeah. Which I think also leads to, I want to get more into your work and how you upcycle. I still want to talk about the technology standpoint.
Yeah.
I almost want to challenge you to say, like, you, so one time my dad's wife's mom,
yeah,
my step grandma,
yeah,
said to me, I was talking about, like, I just wish there was, like, I've never wanted to go back to school ever, yeah, until like now,
yeah,
because I have new interests,
yeah.
So I'm like, I just wish there was like a scholarship program for 30-year-old or however old,
yeah,
or whatever, who, like, all of a sudden have been doing what they've been doing for 10 years, realize they don't like it, want a new career.
University of Slovenia,
right? Yeah. Other than that, like, you know, that funds these, mm-hmm, people. She was like, well, you know, she's like, you seem, you're someone who just, like, when you think there's something needed, you create it. So
yeah. Yeah.
I would like to push that onto you. And with someone with so much of your knowledge and understanding of all these different areas, from, like, the residency circuit, how the grants work, how, like,
yeah,
to sell art to the 1%,
yeah,
to think of solutions for the up-and-coming art, you know? Like, it's got to be something there. I'm not saying you definitely have to be the one to...
No.
But I think it's, like, your generation...
of artists who, yeah, need to be kind of taking that experience and starting to form ideas that young people will come in and, you know, they have their, they were raised on the iPhone, so they'll interject some, like, freshness into it or whatever, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But how can artists bring solutions to this? Is it,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially so specifically socially engaged.
I think artists. That we're doing it in a lot of grant applications. I talk about how there's this zeitgeist of artists that I've been meeting through the residency circuit, through making laps around the world, that are really engaged in this kind of thing, whether they're telling stories about plastic pollution or whether they're telling stories about water rights or whether they're telling stories about Bangladeshi women being burned out of their factory, whether they're telling stories, you know, about whales, I mean, any number of different sociological and environmental issues. The fact that they're doing it tells me that, you know, what we're doing right now, as if you want to call it, I don't really want to call it a movement, but like what I see happening with a lot of contemporary art practitioners is they went through the education system, they got a graduate degree, and they drilled down and they worked really hard through the peer review process to get to where they're going. And I think what they're doing right now is that we don't know what the solutions are going to be yet because we haven't really identified the problem. We're still tripping around that, and that anyone
is
who,
it money the problem?
Well, speculative interest, you know, positive and you know or interest accrual is, if I had to say it, one thing was really the problem, that's probably it. The fact that people can make money on money. I mean, you know, the irony is it's like there's no religion that supports that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like how, hang on, you know, like we're going to be Buddhist or Christian or Muslim or whatever, and we want to make 10% on our investment. Okay. How does that work? Someone winds up losing if that's the case. Mm. And that's what we're doing. And I think that's why, so I think if we can identify the problem, you know, correctly and then have sort of a consensus on it, because that's the other thing too that we kind of have learned from politics and things like this is it's called consensus building, but that's really what's going on. I think that it's like with the climate change thing, and now it's with this economic thing that we're really dealing with. Because I think the 99%ers, you know, that movement got really close to announcing it, but the rest of the world kind of, it's still kind of a moving target as to whether everyone in the rest of the world really understood that conversation. Mm-hmm. And so I think we still have to announce the problem. I think from there, if, you know, long term, you know, some of the people that are really thinking about this, like, you know, former members of the Club of Rome and stuff like that, you know, and this is like 40-year-old information sometimes, but the people who are really thinking about this, they talk about it actually an end of money. That main is probably not in our lifetime. At least I hope not, because I think we should kind of be slow about this. But I think that's ultimately where we'll go, where we'll go back to a society of exchange. It's a tall order, and possibly, you know, maybe the water in Paonia is getting to me a little bit, but it may be too far-fetched. But again, like I said, when we look at the history, it's kind of like, well, that's not working, you know? Yeah. So, like, we're not going to be able to upset the balance of the dominant economic system. That's It's just the rules of the game. We live in a capitalist consumer environment, full stop. That's it.
Yeah.
What we can do is we can modify our own behaviors. And I think that that's kind of what I try to do with my work and what other people I see in the social practice field, like with, you know, with Kevin Doyle, a playwright friend of mine. He's the one that's making a play about the Bangladeshi woman. Mm. You're just getting that story out there will change people's minds that maybe they won't go buy, you know, clothes from, I don't know who's selling it, Nordstrom, or I don't know who's selling them. But, you know, maybe they'll think twice about it when they see a tag that says made in Bangladesh. That will have a huge impact if that retailer, I mean, this is fact, right? Speaking of Nordstrom, I mean, wasn't it like Ivanka Trump's line of clothes that actually got pulled from the racks?
Yeah.
Because customers stopped buying it. See, this is the thing that just drives me, like, this. That's what gives me hope.
Yeah.
People want to say there's no hope, and it's like, well, you know what? Use the tools that you have. And if customers can choose to boycott a product line and then have it removed merely because she's the daughter of the current president, it's like, wow.
That also is an interesting form of protest.
It is.
because it doesn't, people who aren't comfortable getting out there, whether it's because they're scared of their
it's anonymous
safety or, yes, no one knows. No one
and that's the thing. That's what's funny about it, right? Because now we're really using language of the movement. Anonymous, yeah, right. Direct action, boycott. And they didn't have to get arrested. They didn't have to get tear gassed. They didn't cause a traffic jam. You know, and
they can
and
still buy some stupid shirt.
They can still whatever they want. They could buy the Ralph Lauren one. I don't care. You right. know, it doesn't really matter. But by making that simple little choice, they just made a change. Yeah. They just affected a change. And not only that, it's David and Goliath, right? They caused a corporation or a business or a fashion line, a major company, a major endeavor to change their habits. And I think, you know, going back to, you know, one of the other questions you asked, that's also what I remember about the 80s. You know, we turned apartheid off. We were all really close to making Exxon and people like that recognize that they were killing the environment. I think Exxon Valdez was around there somewhere. I can't remember the exact year because it's a little fuggy. But yeah, consumer power has massive effect. And I think that's those are the solutions that the artists are offering right now is educating the public, which is why. Again, why public art is, and that's one of the things that I say, public art has a capacity to inspire and educate the masses. That's just its job, because it's where you can actually share information with someone on an interrogative level that's not just Socratic, but equal. I can put a piece of plastic pollution out there that everyone was kind of convinced didn't exist. I'm like, nope, it's here.
Yeah, so... Honestly, because before meeting you and seeing your piece on drip tape here, like, I feel like an idiot saying it, but whatever, it's true. When I eventually have my garden that I'll eventually have, I would have probably used drip irrigation.
I know.
That's what I grew up with.
But yeah, we've all been there.
Now I know.
Yeah. I've installed the systems.
Right.
You know? Yeah. I've recommended them in construction projects and things like that. And that was all before I really got turned into the plastic thing. But yeah, it's a blind spot. And I think that's what's kind of awkward about the time that we live in right now. There are so many different blind spots in our culture that we've got to address them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Let's talk about how you're able to travel so much and do sculpture with, like, the technology.
With technology? The short answer, like, you know, the first major large-scale work I did was in Ponavan in 2006, a project we called Event Project. And it was 29 vertically suspended translucent scrims suspended along 2 kilometers of river. It was the first project that I designed on a computer. Mm-hmm. And from there, I really realized the advantages of doing that because it budgets, you get material estimates, you can do engineering. And also, you know, I guess I was fortunate in a way because the software was scaling up in a consumer level. It existed for professionals and people who could afford the fancy applications at that time. But it really started becoming more available, not just, you know, the Illustrator and Photoshop, but, you know, you look at today now, you've got SketchUp and Forger and things like this, or Mesh Lab, or 123D, like, programs that are free, or open source, like in the case of Mesh Lab. And so you can do, so that now people can do a lot more, and I can do a lot more, and that was, it dovetailed perfectly with me eliminating the studio, too, because I realized I didn't need to do that. If I could design and tweak and engineer and assess a project's viability and integrity all on the computer without spending any material or time in a physical space, and then even outsource some of that production to someone else, done. And it's one of those things, again, it's connected to consumerism because it's part of the driving force now. Now everything's CAD, now everyone's got CNC, now everyone's got laser cut. Now, I mean, they're selling, they're marketing desktop laser cutting machines for the home so you can help, you know, little Timmy's and little Susie's art project for school, whatever, you know. But I think that those kind of technologies are amazing because we're empowering consumers to be makers, to be creatives, to be artistic, you know, and to bring craft back into the home instead of going down to Walmart and buying an extra earpiece for your eyeglasses. You could just design one real quick and print it. And you're done. What is that going to do to the economy? I don't know. And I also do not think 3D printers are the holy grail. I don't think they're ever going to replace you know, industrially manufactured good. They're just not. A 3D printer is really good for prototyping. It's one-off. Laser, same thing. It's good for one-offs, prototyping. Full circle, like with what I do, with the models and things like that that I make, or the larger scale works where the pieces are getting CNC'd and things like that, it's saving a tremendous amount of time. It's also saving a lot of material. It's kind of a win-win.
And you also mentioned that the client or funder, they like being able to see the rendering because they can see exactly what it's going to look like. Yeah,
they really do. And I think that that's also something that's just happened culturally. You know, like I remember in the early 2000s, there was within the art community, there was massive resistance against, you know, computers and the studio and computer renderings and people, oh, it's not art, that's design. It's kind of come full circle now, and it's because of that, I think, because every artist out there has realized that, you know what, you know, maybe Frank Gehry can get away with drawing a proposal on a cocktail napkin, true story, but artist, I think it's going to help the gallerist, curator, director, commissioner, whatever, a heck of a lot if you can give them a 3D space with the thing that you want to make for them in that 3D space from a few different angles, a few different lighting. And then it also becomes a negotiation tool, you know, like with the, like this project that I'm working on in Puerto Rico right now, where they've opened the door to, you know, much more extensive material possibilities. And it's so much easier now with the computer rendering to swap it out.
Yeah.
Couldn't do that if I was still in a model land or if I was still making things by hand. You know, it's kind of, it does sound a little bit contradictory too, because it doesn't sound like slow economy. It doesn't sound like slow growth.
Right.
On the other hand, we're not wasting materials, we're not wasting time. There's a balance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that gig is with a big hotel chain.
It is. It's with the Ritz-Carlton Reserve. It's the full name is Dorado Beach, a Ritz-Carlton Reserve. It's just somewhat, my impression of it, I don't want to influence the brand, but my impression of it is it's kind of an experimental thing for the Ritz-Carlton because it's three resorts in one. And yeah, it's a big deal. They contacted, we were supposed to do it before Hurricane Maria, and then Hurricane Maria happened and we all pulled back because we wanted to make sure the island could get back together and put itself back together. And the people down there had been, everyone on the island, everyone has been working really hard to put it together and get things back together. And things are good. Things are open for business. But now we really want to have this triennial to kind of celebrate things and say, yeah, Puerto Rico's here. It's doing good. Because Puerto Rico's got an unfortunately complicated status, legal status with the United States. I don't even understand myself. It's unfair. It should be a state, full stop.
Yeah.
Or it should be independent, full stop.
Yeah.
I think that it's not fair for them to still be treated like a colony. Mm-hmm. Or treated like them, like they are the other. That's not fair either. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things to talk about there, and I think that hopefully we'll see. I don't know. But it's an exciting project because it's a kind of a semi-permanent project. And then they've also asked me to develop another project. So, who knows?
Well, yeah. Yeah, that almost seems like it could potentially be a future for, especially socially engaged artists, is corporations who have money who want to do some good.
This is the
not
thing.
Not all corporations have to be evil.
No, and they don't.
Even the evil ones have departments.
Yeah,
with funds who want to do some good.
It's, you know? it's like the sponsor that I had for the plastic bottle project in Utica, New York. It's going to the public zoo there. Same thing.
Mm.
You know, his business is making plastic,
yeah.
And he his name will be on the plaque. Alder Creek, I think, is it? Alder Creek Beverages there, he'll be on the plaque, along with Sculpture Space, along with Shen Ben Foundation and a few others. But I think it's kind of like what Woody Tash was saying, like, what's more likely that we're going to upset the dominant, you know, economic, you know, paradigm, or we're going to make small changes in our individual life that may add to a sort of collective growth here, a collective change? I don't know. But if we were going to get rid of capitalism or corporations, they've been around for a couple hundred years now. Dutch, you know, East India Trading Company was a corporation, was a multinational, was a global entity. This is not news, folks. This is just the status. That's it. And so if we can, I think you're right. Like if we can work with them rather than against them, I think that's a healthier attitude.
And I mean, and this is coming from someone who resists corporations.
For sure. And that's that, and that's the other side of it too. And I think that it's just like, you know, well, I mean, PBS is a public broadcasting corporation, you know? So it's kind of careful what we say, you know? I think that there's, you know, some corporations like Monsanto, yeah, they really, you know, they're not playing nice, you know? But other corporations are still trying to do good, you know? Like, you know, someone like Tesla or something like that, even though they're having problems right now with their stock price, they're trying to do good.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's kind of up to consumers it's kind of up to consumers to take responsibility. I think that's the irony of it too, is that we got too narcissistic and too self-centered on our individualism, and we forgot the collective. And so we forgot to say, you know what, we can actually hold these corporations accountable by not buying their product or by not giving in to their packaging or by not, you know, whatever. Like there's power on both sides, you know? And it's like, what was it? Something like, yeah, no, that's it. I think it's just realizing that if we don't like, they talk about it in this valley a lot with all the fracking and everything like that, but if we don't like what the fossil fuel corporations are doing, then stop buying fossil fuel.
Mm-hmm.
See what happens.
Yeah.
Just try it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a method that we haven't really tried. Instead, what we really have, and everyone kind of needs to fess up to this, is we have a situation where we want to order our cake and have it too. And it's like, you can't have both.
Yeah.
So make a choice. And it's hard, obviously.
What does that mean with like people with cars don't drive their cars? Because they, you know, probably can't afford to trade it in for a hybrid.
No, they should. Yeah, well, I think honestly, you know, like there's a few artists here in town that, you know, we were talking about. They were asking me questions on how to start a community rideshare program for their cars. And I was like, just start it.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, if you
let someone borrow your car one day.
Let someone borrow your car one day and have them put $5 of gas in it or whatever the going rate is for the mileage. You know, like and go from there. I think that just like
small steps.
Don't overcomplicate it. You know, you're not going to have Zipcar or Escargot here by tomorrow. Not going to happen. Okay.
Yeah.
You're not going to get Uber here. Not going to happen. But you might be able to conserve your resources. And again, the irony is that we've been here before. You know, it's like my dad, you talk about stupid jokes. My dad used to tell me this joke from Missouri, Tennessee. I can't remember which, but there's these two old boys and they live on the other side of the hill from each other. And one's got a donkey and one's got a gun. And every season they swap.
Yep.
And that's old hillbilly stuff, but it's not too far off. When you need a gun, you need a gun. When it's not in use, you don't need it.
Yeah.
If you need a donkey to plow your field, then you need a donkey to plow your field. But once you're done plowing the field, then the donkey's just sitting around eating grass. So if your neighbor can use the donkey, then let them take it, you know? And in Cambodia, I saw the same thing. Like, there was some of the rice paddies that were starting to modernize. And the whole entire village, they still kind of call them commune. There's still echoes of communism there. But, you know, the whole entire village might chip in for a rice combine or something like that, or some sort of mechanized machinery to help them do it. Yeah, sure. Because you only need one.
Right.
You don't need 20 of them for all of them to sit idle 8 months of the year. Why would you do that?
Yeah.
You just have one, and they can do all the rice paddies. Everyone's seats get sown. It's a co-op model. We just share in resources, you know, that like this. And I think that that's the consumerist thing that we really went down a rabbit hole on, that we all needed to have cars, we all needed to have, you know, machines. And I mean, and guys are probably, I don't know, maybe the worst, but you know, that every guy needs to have a saw table and wood shop in their garage. Is that really necessary? I mean, unless you're running saws all day long, okay, fine. But if you're just going to have a saw for a hobby, for doing maybe a little small project or something like that, you know, now there's this maker spaces culture and DIY shops and things like this. Those are starting to spring up all over the place. If someone did something like that here in Paoni, I think that would be really smart, because that would be another way. Say, look, here, pay a small fee. You've got a wood shop. You've got, you know, metal shop, whatever you need. There, shared resources. Done. Yeah.
You know? You can get donations, materials, and stuff.
I think you could. And it would just build on itself, because, you know, that's another thing about human behavior is we really do respond to the tangible. We have to see it, touch it, feel it, smell it. Like, that's how we react. And so if someone can be sort of a visionary on that and put that into effect, then that's how you're going to do it. Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
So two questions I ask everyone.
Okay.
One is, what does the word process mean to you?
Yeah. It takes the time it takes. That's what process means to me. And that's not mine, but it's something I learned. Shortly after grad school, like a lot of people, I ran into commercial work, basically, just to protect myself and to have money, because it was after 2008, and I was like freaking out about rent. And I landed a job as a studio manager, chief fabricator for the artist Al Farrow, who makes these reliquary sculptures out of guns and bullets. And it was a gift of a lifetime, because he was a good 30 years my senior. So he had just a ton of experience. And that was something he always used to say. And the first year or two, it annoyed the hell out of me. He'd always be like, take the time it takes, you know. And, you know, like, for the audience, I'm not sure if everyone's on the same page, but when you're dealing with fine art fabrication, you know, especially in sculpture, you have mock-ups, you have stagings, you have dry fits, you have all these things like this. And what does all that mean? That means you've got all sorts of crazy stuff balanced on a table,
yeah.
You know. And the slightest move or anything like that, the whole thing falls down. And, you know, that, and so it would just be, we'd lose days of work sometimes in 5 seconds. And that was always Al's response. Takes the time it takes.
Oh,
but I think it's kind of like process, you know? Mm-hmm. It just takes the time it takes. Because it's like, I'm going to keep working at it. I'm going to keep doing what I'm going to do. But it also just takes the time it takes. You know, the paint's going to dry at the rate it's going to dry at. The welding is going to go at the rate it's going to go at. Like, especially the older I get, I think my family would appreciate this. I've learned that, too. I can't really speed things up. It's just going to happen the way it happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
But patience comes with age, for sure.
There's that. And, well, and I think, and thank you, because that's the moral, too, in the story, is that that's what process really means to me, is patience.
Yeah.
It takes the time it takes. It's just, you know, work at it, but just let it do its thing, too.
It's been a big one for me.
It's hard. I think that's kind of the funny thing, too, about it, you know, being an artist, being a professional artist, I guess. The whole application and rejection process. There's something that happens about it, and I know it's hard for a lot of people, but what I've noticed for me is that I'm invested in my work, but now, having gone through the application and rejection process so many times, I kind of developed a sort of Buddhist Taoist attitude. It's like, okay, didn't get that one, big deal, no worries,
yeah.
Just let it go. Kind of, I don't, you know, trust in the universe, or, you know, again, I guess I really have stayed in Paoni too long, wearing too many hippie hats. But I think that's part of it, though, too. That's part of the patience thing. It's just, it's kind of like the serenity prayer for Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's the same things. There's only so much you can do. Or, like, you know, a friend of mine, Nico Fleming, really, really awesome artist, works primarily in sheetrock, Canadian. I won't hold it against him. But, you know, we used to talk about that, like, you know, stressing out about applications or something like that. And there was one point that I was stressing out about fabrication, because I had, like, 8 days before I got on a plane to finish a project. And, you know, I told him, I said, I'm really kind of stressing out. He's like, well, is it helping? And I was like, no, not really. He's like, well, then don't do it.
Yeah.
Nico's really kind of, he just has a dry sense of humor. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
But I think that's the other side of it, too, is that it's hard, because you do, I think we all kind of, it's professionalism, really. You know, we hunger for opportunities, we hunger for getting just that one gig that we know is going to make everything right. It takes the time it takes. It'll happen when it happens, and that's it. You know, getting, you know, doing whatever that you're doing now, if it's working, do that, keep doing that. If it's not, then change it.
Yeah.
You know, I've watched way too many of my colleagues do that, where far too many of them are kind of doing the same thing that they did when they were in grad school, and they're not seeing any sort of success. And it's like, well, I'm sorry, but there's the phone's ringing.
Right.
You might want to reconsider your strategies and methodologies here. Mm-hmm. You know? Whatever.
Yeah. Last question. Mm. What is something you're excited about today? Gotta be something, John.
I know. There's a lot. I mean, I'm excited about a lot of different things in my own practice, my own work. But I think when it comes to the world, I really am excited to see what happens tomorrow. I think that's what's the most interesting thing, you know, because of all the different changes that are underway, good or bad. I hope that there is a movement to wake up.
Yeah.
And so I get excited about tomorrow because I feel like there is. Because there's a lot of us talking about it. There's a lot more people talking about how society and culture needs to wake up than there was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So I think there's a change happening. And I think that we have to, all of us, kind of have to trust in that.
Yeah.
And stay vigilant, not get naive, don't lose the thread, stay on the story. But don't give up hope either, because this is happening. This is really happening. People are talking about changes. People are talking about, you know, solutions that are informed. And I think that's big. That's exciting. So, yeah, I'm excited for tomorrow.
Love it.
Yeah, thank you.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, Shannon.